Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today our guest is Malaine Webster, who is a Master of Social Work student in the Department of Social Work at Utah State University. She was named winner of the Policy Pitch Competition, a statewide contest hosted by the Policy Project. This happened last month, and Webster presented her proposal to reform Utah's criminal debt collection system before a live audience and a bipartisan panel of legislators, policy experts, and practitioners at the Policy Pitch Summit. That was held in Salt Lake City. Chosen from 115 submissions, Webster's pitch addressed a challenge she's seen firsthand in her work as community justice advocate. Utahns trying to rebuild their lives after court involvement often face a debt collection system in which fines, fees, and penalties grow faster than they can realistically pay. Malaine Webster, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to be here.
Let me ask you first, why you're in the, the Department of Social Work, getting your Master of Social Work. What do you want to accomplish there?
Yeah, so I originally graduated from BYU about almost 20 years ago now, and spent the last 20 years raising my six kids, and my youngest headed off to preschool. I knew it was time for me to go back to work and do some good in the world, hopefully. And social work was the avenue I chose to do that, to hopefully make a difference. And I've really, really loved the Utah State program. It's been fantastic.
Yeah. Have you had experiences or met people that kind of moved you in this area?
Oh, absolutely. So I would say my first introduction to social workers in general was about when I was in college. I struggled with an eating disorder and had some really great experiences with social workers that helped me through that difficult time. And so that was a real inspiration to me. And over the last 20 years, I've done a lot of volunteer work in the eating disorder field and in recovery centers and different places, and have just been exposed to lots of different nonprofit work. I've run a nonprofit myself for about the last 10, 15 years, along with a couple other gals out here in Tooele County, and just love the nonprofit field and got interested in social policy, though, more since starting the social work program. I have a really great professor, Sean Camp. I hope it's okay if I'm dropping his name.
Yeah, for sure.
Super huge inspiration to me. I absolutely loved my first social policy class, my first year in the program. I'm in the three-year part-time program, so I'm in my last year now. But in my first year, I really realized I was very interested in macro social work, so kind of the bigger upstream root causes of social issues. And so I just really love the opportunity to really affect a wide swath of people with the work that I do. Although there's so much value in the micro work, which is one of the cool things about the Community Justice Advocate program, is I've gotten to do both micro and macro level work.
I want to return briefly to your nonprofit. We could spend a whole program on that, but we won't. But what was your nonprofit you put together?
Yeah, sure. About 15 years ago, one of our neighbors passed away from cancer, and we just really wanted to do something to honor her memory. And so we started up a 501c3 called Kicking Cancer's Can out here in Tooele County. And every year we put on a really large event. We'll be coming up this October. I guess I'll throw in a plug.
All right.
October 3rd. And we just help local individuals battling cancer, families, to raise money for them. We have a really, really great fun event. Bring in, 30, 40,000 each year that we're able to give to these families.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So before we get into your proposal here, tell me about your work as a community justice advocate. Tell us first what that is.
Yeah, sure. It's a really exciting new innovative program that Utah State has started. So there's something in Utah called the Utah Legal Regulatory Sandbox, which really just allows organizations to come up with innovative solutions to meet problems in our state. And one of the big problems in our state is the access to justice issue. We have thousands and thousands of individuals in our state that need legal help for various reasons and are unable to afford that help. And so this program was created to train existing human service professionals, so social workers like myself, domestic violence workers. We've even had individuals working in school districts, people that are just really in the trenches, boots on the ground, seeing people in their the things they're facing. And helping, being able to help them with some of the legal issues they're facing, specifically related to debt. So particularly consumer debt. And so being able to help them further upstream, hopefully before they get to the legal system, but also able to help them through the litigation system, post-litigation system, garnishments, things like that. So we're able to give legal information, legal advice, perform limited scope legal services free of charge to individuals in the state. And so I was in that first cohort of trained people left and became a certified community justice advocate about a year ago and have been working in that for the last year.
Tell me a little bit about that work. It must be fulfilling, gratifying, hopefully, right? To help people in that way.
Absolutely. It's been really eye-opening to me. I have gotten to know some really incredible individuals. I think individuals that are often kind of overlooked and really in vulnerable positions. But being able to spend time with them and really to see them as real, the real complex, beautiful people that are trying their darndest to do good in the world and to get on their feet and be able to just be there for them. It's interesting to be trained in both legal issues as well as social work, to have that lens of being able to, I don't want to say all lawyers come at it this way, but sometimes, it's more cut and dry. It's very from a legal, transactional perspective, whereas we're able to come in with more of a human focused, I guess, perspective, a trauma-informed perspective, and really sit with people in the hard things they're facing. And a lot of it is listening and hearing them and help and helping them to cope, but then also being able to help them in really practical ways with their legal problems has been very fulfilling, very exciting.
So last month, there were 115 submissions to the policy project for their policy pitch summit. This is they build this as their first annual, and I think it's a great thing that Policy Projects is doing. They're reaching out to regular citizens, right? For give us your ideas, and some of these do filter over to the legislature and become law. So this is the policy pitch summit. You were chosen as one of three finalists. You then presented, right? And then we've already, skipped to the end. You're the winner of the competition, so congratulations. So as I mentioned at the beginning, the problem you're trying to address is Utahns trying to rebuild their lives after court involvement often face debt collection system, which fines, fees, and penalties grow faster than they can realistically pay. And so then the punishment, the fines become part of the reason maybe they don't get rehabilitated back into society. Maybe flesh that out for me, what the overall problem, and then we'll get to your solution.
Sure. That's something I started to see pretty quickly is individuals that are really trying to reintegrate back into society after incarceration. I guess I'll say some of our referrals as community justice advocates come from Clean Slate Utah, RASA Legal, these different organizations that are helping people in the reentry population to expunge their criminal records. But in order to do that, in order to expunge their criminal record, which is essential for being able to obtain better vocational opportunities, better housing, they have to pay off any debts that they have owed to the court system. But interestingly, those debts don't stay in the court system. Typically, the day that they're sentenced, if they are incarcerated, it gets transferred immediately to our state's collections agency, the Office of State Debt Collections. And on the day that happens, that very first day, the court debt, they tack on a lot of fees and penalties, about 25%. So if they had, say, a $2,000 debt that was transferred over, immediately $500 was put on there, plus an ongoing interest that is accumulated over time. And a lot of these individuals are spending time in prison for several years. So they have no opportunity to in prison. They have no reasonable way to actually work on these debts. And yet they're over there growing and growing and growing. And in a lot of cases, there's no education about these debts whatsoever. So, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to talking about Cheyenne, who I talked about in my pitch, but her story is pretty, I've heard over and over. They didn't even know the debts existed. And we're never contacted, we're never told about them. And so, even once they're out of prison, years and years and years go by, and these debts just continue to grow and grow and grow. And then once they're finally, you know, really turning their life around and motivated to get their record expunged, all of a sudden they're met with this massive debt, crushing debt that keeps them from being able to move forward and is really a source of real despair and hopelessness for them.
And as you note in your speech, we shouldn't be surprised if some of them make the wrong choice again, right? If you're working minimum wage, you got this crushing debt, there's no relief from it, you can make more money doing illegal stuff, et cetera, not to excuse it, but you know, to explain it. Yeah, tell me about Cheyenne.
Yeah, so Cheyenne is one of many great individuals I've met. you know, I think it's easy to think of individuals who've been involved in the justice system a certain way. And until you actually get to rub shoulders with them and really get to know them as real human beings. Anyways, it was definitely eye-opening for me to see that these aren't people that are trying to shirk accountability, at least the ones that I've come into contact. These are people like Cheyenne who are doing everything in their power to be accountable, that feel a real debt to society to make up for you know, past mistakes. So Cheyenne, she grew up really in a really difficult situation from her earliest years, just subjected to a lot of abuse. Her mother had a lot of men in the home that were abusive, was introduced to drugs when she was just 12 years old, spent all of her teens and early 20s homeless, in and out of jail for different reasons. Really though, eventually she just is such a resilient, incredible person, and she eventually was able to get her feet under her and get some help and get some rehabilitation. And she has been sober now for over 17 years. She's married with three beautiful kids, and she is, I mean, I first heard of Cheyenne actually not as my client. I heard of her through so many different circles of individuals at Utah State out here in Tooele County in the justice system who are just so impressed with her and the work and the contribution she's making out here. She is really the lifeblood of the reentry strategies program, both at the Tooele County criminal justice system and also with Utah State University Extension. And she just is a force for good in the rehab community and in the reentry community. Anyways, she's just doing amazing things with her life, and yet she has tried over and over to address this debt that she didn't find, again, she didn't find out about for about 2 decades after the debts were originally incurred. And she has paid, and she has paid, and she has paid towards this debt, and yet she still owes twice as much as she originally, the original court fine that was given to her. And she still can't get that record expunged. Feels like she'll, you know, she has resigned herself to that this is just what it's going to be. It's going to be this way for the rest of my life. Doesn't matter how much good I do. She's gotten a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. She's a substance use counselor. She's just incredible. And yet she's just still shackled by this piece of her past that we just won't let go.
So yeah, we do a lot of you know, officials will tout the expungement program, right? Clean Slate Utah works to get people there. But I guess what you're pointing out is you can't get your record expunged until you pay off that debt.
Yeah, that's the thing is Clean Slate and RASA both are sending these people over to us because they can help with all the other parts, you know, the technical aspects of filing the paperwork and meeting the whatever other hurdles there are. But when it comes to the debt, it can't move forward until that is at zero.
And then the debt itself can become a real, I guess, albatross, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, when I get into your proposal, three, I guess, three parts in your proposal, which was the winning proposal at the Policy Pitch Summit, the first annual, which happened last month in Salt Lake City. We're talking with Melaine Webster, Master of Social Work student in the Department of Social Work at Utah State University. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with Malaine Webster, who is a Master of Social Work student in the Department of Social Work at Utah State University. She won the inaugural Policy Pitch Competition, a statewide contest hosted by the Policy Project that happened last month. 115 submissions, three finalists, and we're talking to the winner of that competition today. Her proposal has to do with a problem. Utahns trying to rebuild their lives after court involvement often face a debt collection system in which fines, fees, and penalties grow faster than they can realistically pay. And until you pay all that off, you can't get your record expunged either. So, Malaine Webster, there was in 2020, you mentioned in your speech here that Utah conducted a performance audit of this office. I guess that's where the debts go. And sometimes people don't know it's even transferred over there, and that's who you need to pay it to. Tell me about this audit.
Sure. So, yeah, the problems that I've seen in my community justice advocate work are not new ones. As I started seeing them, I started doing a little digging, and I found that there was this audit conducted in 2020. And it really identified and laid out the exact problems that I'm seeing still 6 years later. So it found that people sentenced directly to prison were not given a fair opportunity to pay before OSDC fees and penalties were imposed. Those were added to the debt. That there really wasn't any realistic opportunity for individuals to pay while they were in prison, and that debts grew substantially during that time. They also found that the settlement practices at OSDC were really inconsistent, really unclear, not any clear policies or guidelines going on. And interestingly, that OSDC was collecting millions more in fees and penalties and interest than it even really needed to run itself. The audit really ended with kind of a poignant question to the legislature, asking them to consider whether it's really ethical and whether we should be generating excess revenue from people who are really struggling just to get back on their feet.
So Cheyenne's original debt was $2,000, now ballooned up to $8,000, in part because she didn't know it was there and it was accumulating interest, I suppose, right?
Right, exactly.
Including during vulnerable times, you know, when people are incarcerated and during time when they're trying to get back on their feet after jail. So that's one instance. What did you find when you looked into this? What's kind of the range of the amounts that are
sitting
there?
Sure, yeah. So Cheyenne's debt, I use that as an example, but it's really a small example. I want to emphasize that it's not small to members of this population. That is a massive amount for them to try to overcome. But I would say on average, debts over there are ranging anywhere from 10 to 40,000, I would say, on average, and have been as high as over 300,000, close to $350,000. So really, really an impossible hurdle for many of these people to overcome, and really is what leaves people with a lot of despondency and despair and just not being able to see any kind of way forward.
So take us through your proposal. The 3 points here is what you're actually proposing to reform the system.
Sure. So the first point is that accountability should be proportional. And what I mean by that is that original sentence should remain the sentence in its intention and purpose. And so in order to do that, I think it's important to suspend any additional punishment in the form of interest and penalties during periods when people have no realistic ability to pay. So, and I identified that as periods of incarceration, periods of verified treatment where people are really trying to work towards a better future for themselves in rehabilitation, as well as those first to 6-12 months of reentry back into society. Because people are, you know, really, really working hard to secure housing, find employment, you know, comply with their treatment guidelines, and starting to have to, you know, face that debt right all at once is probably a little more than is realistic. And I like to compare it to like student loans. You know, the way we treat the middle class is a little different. When people first come out of school or while they're in school, we often have these periods called grace periods, you know, where you have an opportunity to kind of get going, to start making some income. And I think they should be afforded that same opportunity.
So suspending that, the interest at least, what, during incarceration, right, I guess, treatment, I guess, and period of reentry, how long a period do you think in reentry should we forgive?
I'm suggesting about 6 to 12 months of reentry.
Yeah.
Period, I think, is minimal, but also realistic.
So tell me about the second part of your proposal.
So the second is that accountability should be realistic. So in my work as a community justice advocate with Utah State and the Transforming Communities Institute, one of the biggest things we're trained to do in helping individuals with debt is to negotiate, to create settlements. So people that owe these crippling debts, working with the creditors to come to some kind of compromise, some kind of settlement that makes it realistic for them to both pay it off and get it behind them, and also for the creditor to get some money, right? And so what I found, though, is in our work with OSDC is that there is no room for that. There's no room for settlement and negotiation. And although the legislature has given them that right and those abilities in recent years to take less, to take into consideration rehabilitation and community service, to offer payment plans as low as $50 a month, they are not doing that in practice. And what we're seeing in practice is they either require a very, very, very large, almost the full amount lump sum settlement right up front, which members of this population do not have, or a repayment plan that is really compressed into just a very short period of 18 months. So try to imagine paying a $40,000 debt in just 18 months. That's a massive payment for individuals that are often, you know, really living on the poverty level, making, you know, $1,500, $2,000 a month. There is no wiggle room there. And so they throw up their hands and say, well, I tried to, you know, I want to pay, I want to make this right, but there's no realistic way forward for me. And so my proposal is that the OSDC should be required to be willing to make payment plans with individuals that are realistic according to their ability to pay. I suggest using the federal poverty guidelines as kind of a guide, as well as household expenses, household size. Again, very similar to a kind of model off student loans and income-driven student loan repayment plans. Again, for the middle class, we give these kind of options to make it realistic for them to be able to pay in a period that's realistic for them. And I think they should be afforded that same opportunity.
You look at overall state revenue within this office, right? The question you propose is, if your proposal is adopted, wouldn't collections go down?
Right. Good point. And so that's a question I really looked at. And I've looked at a lot of surrounding states and other places that have, you know, we're not the only state dealing with this issue. So one of the big issues is that OSDC doesn't collect a lot anyways. So collection rate is very, very low. As of January 2025, the director of OSDC reported that they collected about $18 million, which on the $1.8 billion owed on paper. So about 1% is what they're collecting currently. And so I think that part of that reason is because they're not making it realistic for people who want to pay. There are people who want to pay into the system, that want to set up payment plans, or even want to give large lump sum settlements that they won't accept. And so I have looked at other states that have addressed this issue. There are some really neat pilot programs out of a couple other states where they have done exactly what I'm proposing, and they've granted fee reductions or the ability to opt into payment plans that are consistent with their ability to pay. And in those situations, we're seeing a 61% full repayment rate. And in those studies, compared to those that weren't given these options, the payment rate was around 29%. So we're seeing twice as high of a payment rate when people are given this flexibility in payment options.
Let me just pause to ask you, all we have is anecdote here, but with the people that you've talked to, the people you work with who are in this system, they generally want to pay this off, want to get that done, because there's a stereotype out there that some of these folks are going to try to wiggle out of this as best they can. And,
And my proposal does not erase the current systems we have in place to address those issues. Garnishment is absolutely still an option for individuals trying to avert the system and not trying to voluntarily pay off their debts. These options are meant to be for those people that are trying to make it right, that are trying to move forward, trying to work on their records, giving them options to actually be able to move forward. But of course, those options are still in place to use compulsory means for those who are avoiding the system altogether.
And as we've mentioned before, for some of these folks, like Cheyenne, the big prize they're going for is expungement.
Absolutely.
Got to pay this off before you get there, right?
Absolutely. And the symbolic meaning of that for these people who have tried to really turn their lives around, being able to leave that part in the past is really important for them on an emotional level, too.
Tell me about the third and final part piece of your proposal.
So my third proposal is that accountability should be rehabilitative. And so I really believe that Utah is a state that stands for a lot of beautiful things. I believe we believe in redemption and public safety and family and service and work. And I think that our policies should reflect those really beautiful Utah Valley's values. And so what I proposed is allowing people to earn credit towards court debts, OSDC debt, through the very behaviors that we say we want to see from this population. We want to see treatment. We want to see rehab. We want to see education, work, service. We want to see all these things. And I think those things should be rewarded. And I think it's important to say, I don't think that that should apply to victim restitution. I think victim restitution should always remain protected. I'm not talking about reducing that. But for the fees and interest and fines that we that have grown and accumulated, I think there should be a way for individuals to reduce that through these behaviors that are really associated with public safety and these other outputs that we really want to see as a state.
There's a model you cite, Texas law. Tell me about that.
Yep. Yeah, so Texas has already done this. They have a really great model for this. They allow fines and fees to be discharged through community service. But the really neat thing is that they define community service very broadly. So community service is anything that is contributing to community well-being and public safety. And they specifically define that in the statute to include education, job training, treatment, counseling, mentoring, and other verified rehabilitative activities. And so I think it's important to say that Utah has made some progress in this area. Just in, I believe, in 2025, there was a bill passed to allow for community service for this very purpose. But the problem, in a practical sense, is that only applies while fees and fines are still sitting with the courts, which, as I mentioned, when an individual is incarcerated, they are immediately transferred to this state collections agency. And once they are there, that no longer applies. Community service cannot be used towards these things. So I think that that should be broadly required, that OSDC also has to honor that that statute as well.
In your speech, by the way, you sent me a copy. I've been referring to it. People wonder how I could do that. You sent me a copy. I'll just quote you this line. What somebody like Cheyenne needs is a system where hope is possible because accountability has a finish line. Accountability has a finish line. That's, I guess, the whole that sums up the reason for your proposal.
Absolutely. I hope is really what it's all about to me. I think at its heart, accountability should call people forward, not hold them down. It should help call them to rise up. And I think that's what we stand for as a state. And I just want our policies and systems to align with what I believe we really believe as Utahns.
So I'm assuming your hope is that this gets adopted wholesale by the legislature in the next session. You tell me.
Absolutely. No, that is the goal. So this is something I was working on long before this competition came up. I had this competition forwarded to me from a professor, and I already had, you know, all the groundwork done. So I was like, oh, perfect opportunity for a platform and maybe get this heard a little bit. And that is exactly what it's done. And I've been able to get in contact with multiple legislators, bipartisan legislators on both sides of the aisle that are very interested and invested in the idea and excited to work on writing a bill and taking it forward into the next legislative session. So
some interest. Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
I should say the Policy Pitch Summit, there are legislators there, right? Along with policy experts and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. Each policy that was pitched had a panel including legislators, both Democratic and Republican legislators, as well as issue experts specifically on the issue being presented on. And so that was a really neat part of the summit, was getting to rub shoulders and really, you know, spitball and throw out ideas and work through the ideas together and some of the challenges we might face with that really powerful think tank.
Yeah. So are you still working as a community justice advocate?
Yes, I am. So my internship for my social work program is through the Transforming Communities Institute at Utah State. And we're actually working to extend that community justice advocate program currently into other areas, into housing and eviction, potentially into domestic violence issues in the future. And I'm hoping to be a part of that as they move forward.
So I guess those are some of the areas you might be interested in working in.
Mm-hmm,
or I guess maybe tell me, is there a specific area you once you graduate you want to focus on?
Oh, that I want to work in. I would actually love to keep working with the Transforming Communities Institute. I love it here. I absolutely love what the model is based on. It's based on community engaged research, which is really what the Policy Pitch Summit did. Is what you mentioned at the beginning, this idea of talking to the people, and really hearing from the bottom up what is needed, and that's exactly what the Transforming Communities Institute does as well. They go into our communities, get the voices of the people, do research, and then help to make change. And that's exactly what inspires me. And I absolutely love the mission.
Let me ask you here, just a couple of minutes left, about the experience of being selected out of a more than 100 people to be one of the finalists, pitching, and then winning at this first annual Policy Pitch Summit.
It was definitely came as a surprise to me. I was really excited about the competition and the idea of it, but I certainly didn't expect to be a finalist or to win. I just really have been so impressed with that organization, with the Policy Project and all that they're doing, and just the opportunity that they gave to us to have that platform and to have that recognition. I think it's going to inspire a lot of people to get involved in policy issues. So it's pretty exciting. It was a really exciting experience for me. Definitely solidified for me that this is where I want to be. This is a field that I love. And just to get to rub shoulders with some of the women there at the Policy Project was a really, really exciting and inspiring experience.
So for you personally, you've got what, another year left in your program?
That was my last year. I'll graduate in April.
Yeah.
Super excited.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are you doing it all there in Tooele?
Not all, mostly, primarily. All my coursework is out here or online. But with my internship at TCI, the Transforming Communities Institute at Utah State, I do drive up to Logan a couple times a month to be up there with my team. And that's been really fun to get to be up there and associate with faculty and my colleagues up there as well.
And with six kids.
That's yes.
Busy, busy time. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is.
Well, they wonderful.
Keep me hopping for sure.
Yeah, yeah. What do your kids think about your studies?
They thought it was pretty exciting. You know, I check in with them every now and then, like, guys, are you feeling neglected? Do you feel like I'm there for all the things you need? And they've been so supportive and excited about what I'm doing. The competition especially was pretty exciting to them. And think that their mom's pretty cool right now.
Very good. That's wonderful. That's what you want. Well, we'll see where this proposal goes. Hopefully, it will be picked up from the legislature and adopted. So we've been talking with Malaine Webster, Master of Social Work student in the Department of Social Work at Utah State University. She was winner of the inaugural Policy Pitch Competition statewide contest held last month by the Policy Project. Malaine Webster, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Coming up following a break, we're going to turn to Leo T. And you might look at the calendar. It's not Thursday. We usually have Leo T. with his Skywatcher segment on Thursdays. But he sent us an interview. Fascinating research is going on at University of Utah. We'll hear about it following this break.
We're here at the Kachina again. Hi, Holly.
Hi there.
Holly Holman is an amazing biomedical engineer at the University of Utah, as well as a pilot, and she's having an incredible adventure finding parallels between aviation and her science.
So I'm studying the inner ear organs at the University of Utah, namely the five vestibular organs, the three semicircular canals, the utricle and the saccule. And I was doing this for quite a long time, and I kept going down to the microscope room, and every time I was examining this particular region in the semicircular canals of these new cells, we were using a fluorescent microscope and some new tools that are available to target specific cells fluorescently based on GCAMP. And I thought for sure that people had discovered these cells previously, so I spent an equal amount of time in the early days, and this was about 10 years ago, doing searches online, PubMed and other search engines, to try and find other people's description of these cells that were always lighting up every time I went to the microscope, and I couldn't find anything. And that, at that time, my friend and mentor was on a sabbatical. He's one of the world's experts in this field of vestibular region, Rick Rabbit, and he was gone. So I just kept imaging and searching the literature, and eventually I thought that what I was looking at was unique and new to the field. And when he came back, I showed it to him, and he was mildly interested. And then I decided to be bold and try a new microscope. At that time, it was an amazing graduate student who had built this new microscope where we could image these organs in as they were living tissues. One of the main challenges of studying the inner ear organs is they're really small and they're really inaccessible. So right now we have a few techniques that we can use to look at them underneath such a microscope. So this particular afternoon, I reached out to my colleague and I said, come on, let's get into the lab. Let's look at these cells under this new live microscope. And we were both sitting there running the microscope and turning on the fluorescence. And we looked over at the screen and these cells were flashing as if they were signaling. Yes, it was really exciting. I think both of us jumped out of our chairs. I wasn't that surprised. I thought that there was something really special and unique about these cells.
Kind of knew it was going that way after all your work.
Well, the fact that I had spent probably more than a year, almost every day, going and looking at different organs and always seeing these cells, they were always lighting up. I thought that fundamentally meant that there was something significant to these cells that otherwise I might see them one day and not another, but that wasn't the case. They were consistently always there and always fluorescing. What I hadn't done until this moment, about a year and a half later or so, was put them under this new microscope to see that they were signaling. And it was kind of reminiscent of the glial cells in the brain. So for a really long time, everybody was really focused on the neurons. We know that they signal. That's really important for function, brain function. But really in the last 10 years, maybe 15, with new tools, scientists, neuroscientists have discovered that glial cells that we thought were just glue cells supporting the neurons in the brain were just that, just a support structure. But now we know with these new tools that glial cells are signaling equally and perhaps signaling to the neurons and vice versa. So whether that's happening in the sensory organs like the vestibular system or the auditory system is still in its early stages, and I'm really excited to be part of that.
And this is all in the inner ear canal.
Correct. Well, so we have the external ear that we think about, but if you go through the canal, through the tympanic membrane, through the stapes, you see six tiny organs, and only one is for our sense of hearing, but there are five more that are kind of orphaned organs, and they are responsible for our sense of balance and our sense of gravity. So if we're thinking about outer space and microgravities, we can thank our vestibular organs, hopefully, to give us our sense of gravitational pull and forward motion.
So we can stand up.
Yes, and unfortunately, it happens that sometimes people wake up and things happen with these organs, and the room is spinning, and that's a real problem.
So this is very important for pilots.
Yes. So getting to the intersection where I was doing this science, probably 2 or 3 years into this research, I saw an announcement for a Girls in Aviation Day, and I thought, well, I was probably not their target audience. I was a little bit older, but it seemed like a really fun idea, and it was at one of the smaller general aviation airports in South Valley. This was probably similar, like 10 years ago or so, and I thought, well, this would be totally different and really fun, and I really like the idea of doing STEM activities in the community for students of all ages. So I went along one Saturday morning, and there were several booths. There was a booth for aviation mechanics, for flying flight schools. These were early days, and at that time, there was a small group of students at Westminster College in their aviation program that has since closed, but at that time, it was really thriving, and the students had organized this event. And so I went up to their table and I told them what I did, and they were so welcoming, and they immediately planted a seed to me, role reversal learning from the students in that moment. They let me know that a lot of student pilots kind of had a struggle with human factors, the aspect of what are our vestibular organs doing in flight, and especially during night flights when spatial disorientation becomes a real problem in general aviation. And so they invited me along to their monthly meetings for women in aviation. And I started going and sharing my knowledge about human factors and the inner ear organs. And I started learning about aviation and becoming a pilot. And with their encouragement, I decided I should try and learn how to fly.
Oh, so you hadn't even, that was when you got the stimulus to learn how to fly.
Yeah, the encouragement, just the support in that student-run group. It's a larger group. There are local chapters throughout the country and the world, but it was just so much fun and so different to the science and the research I was doing that I really enjoyed it, and with their encouragement, I decided to start at a flight school and start learning about aviation a little more deeply so that I could relate more what I'm doing in the lab to how it affects pilots.
You've been listening to an interview with Holly Holman, a biomedical engineer at the University of Utah working on the inner ear and a major breakthrough. And I'm Leo T.